Hey listeners, is your morning cup of coffee tasting a little less flavorful than you expected? The secret to a great cup is starting with fresh beans, and at Joe Bean Roasters, they roast and ship daily, so you get super fresh coffee every single time. If you want to level up your morning routine, check out their new Guide to Brewing Better Coffee at Home, which covers everything from grind size to water quality. You can get cheap shipping straight to your door or choose convenient local pickup at Joe Bean or at Peppermint. Head to JoeBeanRoasters.com and use the promo code LUNCHADOR10 at checkout for 10% off your order. Thanks to Joe Bean for sponsoring the Lunchador Podcast Network.
You guys just asked me if I want to record. Just start recording anytime. As far as I'm concerned, this is the podcast. We just talk. I don't even do like a really good interview, Greg. That's my problem. That's why I got out of radio and got into sauce making, because I'm not good at it. But I keep doing this to itch the itch, I guess. But
no, the sauce is keeping it real. Just having a conversation. So I'm down for
it real. I'm glad you're not in the same room, because if you smelled me right now, I just came straight from the plants. Not good. It's not a good deal. I go around town smelling like chili meat sauce. Let me ask you a Denver question, though. Did John Elway do that thing that all quarterbacks do when they're legends in their towns? Did he open some steakhouses, restaurants, things like this? Is there a bunch of John Elway stuff around town?
Yes, there is, of course. Yeah, and there was the John Elway used car extravaganza when we first moved here with the huge banner and everything. And so all sorts of stuff, but he is legendary here. He's beloved. We also have adopted Peyton Manning, now Bo Nix and others. And so it's a good football town.
My big thing is that I decided to go through all my old baseball and football cards and stuff. And I had a John Elway rookie card, and I decided that was it. I was set for life, right? Obviously this thing's worth millions of dollars. So I took it to see, and it was worth like $72 or something. I was like, ah, this was my retirement plan, my John Elway card. Oh, Greg, we're excited to have you. Rochester Rotary, May 12th, Riverside Convention Center, rochesterrotary.org. Click on events to buy tickets. Are you from, born and raised in Colorado?
No, I'm from Southern California originally. We moved around a ton, so I lived in the Midwest, New England, East Coast. I lived in London for a year, Sweden for 10 years. This is our second tour, Colorado, Texas briefly, so kind of all over the place.
What was that driven by, military, or what were your parents up to?
Yeah, it was my father's business career. He would basically have new opportunities every 3 or 4 years. He was actually in the Army briefly, but the moves were business driven, so chasing a new opportunity. And then eventually he got into turnarounds and would do those. So we got to see a lot of different places in the country.
I didn't know much about your father, but I read that he was a turnaround CEO. Does that mean he would go into companies that were close to failure and turn them around? Because that sounds very stressful, but also potentially very fun if it works.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what he ended up becoming, a turnaround CEO for the last two jobs he had. So for about 10 years, he did one in Texas and he did one in Florida. You're exactly right, Paulie. It's basically the company was crashing. There was a financial mess, and often there was an ethical mess too. There was a component of it. They lost trust, whatever, having some regulatory investigation. So he would be brought in from the outside to try to clean it up, and would clean house, bring in a new team often, and figure out who stays and who goes, try to stabilize the patients and get it going again. And he was masterful of that. And tough job. He said it was like each one was like giving a lung or giving a kidney, basically. But, you know, working on the culture, working on the finances and the business model. But a lot of it was culture and alignment. And so, you know, great opportunity for impact. And he was terrific at it.
I'm just guessing, but I would think when you go into a company that's crashing like that, you know, you're probably going to see some patterns company after company. And I was wondering, you said cultural, it seems like, or did he share with you, what is that one thing all those companies had in common when he got in there and he was on his third day in the job and he's meeting with people? Because my guess would be that they're all pointing at everyone's blaming everybody and he's got to clean that up because everyone hates everyone because it's everyone else's fault and blah, blah, blah. It's my guess.
Yeah, I think that maybe one of the common themes, I think, was that the senior management team, it was more about them and their status and their position. It was like a country club and like what they could get out of it, not paying attention to it. And then in another case, the board was kind of out to lunch, but also it was about their prestige as board members and that not following along and then letting things slide. They were too insular, I think. And so really not having a commitment to, you know, servant leadership was a big part of the philosophy that he developed eventually. That's not the way he started in his career coming out. And just complete integrity, honesty, transparency. You know, we can't, there's nothing to hide. We just have to be fully open with workers, with the board, with the media, with, you know, et cetera, and just kind of start from scratch and really build trust. So there was a lot of broken trust, and it was the higher ups, it was about them and what they would get out of things as opposed to really building something of value for the workers, for the customers, for the community.
Did you want to be just like him? I mean, if I came to you in high school, say I came to you 12th grade, graduation day, Greg, what are you going to be when you grow up? How would you have answered that question that day?
Yeah, for me, it was very much not the case. In fact, my dad and I used to have these, I won't call them arguments, you know, kind of debates and philosophical discussions about. So one of the strains was that he said it was like giving up a lung or a kidney. So it was very demanding to do turnaround and to lead at the high level of being a chief executive officer of large corporations, global, et cetera. But it was caused, you know, demands that caused him to be away a lot. And I was very much kind of thinking like, can you succeed and do well in business or whatever your chosen endeavor, but also have the other things in life? And this has become a theme of my work. You know, I focus on crafting your life and work. And so, and then back then I was much more interested in politics and public policy. And, you know, I was interested in being kind of a statesman and public service and these kinds of things. And I'm still interested. I follow the news like crazy, really, you know, watch it. And it's obviously important. But I ended up working on a political campaign that really caused me to question whether I wanted to be in that business with, you know, with so much of the influence of money and the getting a, you know, front seat look of what you actually end up doing as a candidate versus the kind of the dream of it or the ideal version of it. So I found myself on a different path.
So I was reading about your business past. It looks like K-12 Inc. was kind of the big hit for you, right? That's where you are. You really make a name for yourself in the business world. That's your thing. Were you a founder of that? Were the CEO? What was the role at K-12?
No, I was part of the initial senior management team. The company basically had a solo founder who was a brilliant kind of visionary, but also kind of a quirky, mercurial entrepreneur. He saw a big problem, and then I was networked. I was coming out of the think tank world, back to public policy and the foundation world, where I became an expert in education policy, K-12 education reform, school. And in particular charter schools. And that was my first book that I co-authored. And so then I wanted to pivot and transition over into business. And so I was networked in that world, had a chance to go interview, you know, while the company was still in its kind of idea stage. and landed the job to be part of the initial senior management team. So there were like five or six of us in a room, you know, and then we built the company, and it became a scale up. It was a, you know, real exciting roller coaster. We had a lot of challenges. We almost ran out of cash a couple times, but ended up surviving. And you know, 4 years later, we had hundreds of employees, and I think it was like $60-65 million in sales or something on the way to an IPO. So it was quite an education in business, culture, leadership, alignment. Sure. What not to do as well.
I was going to ask, because I read about your life and the things you teach it occurs to me likely that a lot of these things are probably things that at some point in your life you made that mistake. Who better to speak about how to overcome something than somebody who has overcome it before? I mean, you said what not to do. In that experience and other experiences in life, have you gotten it wrong as a leader at times?
Definitely. I have, and we have made a lot of big mistakes. My experience, Pauly, is that there's a lot of bad managers out there and mediocre managers. It's really difficult to be a manager and to be a leader, to be a founder, an entrepreneur, certainly. Some of the most challenging environments, you know, turnarounds like my dad, startups, you know, like I was involved with. One of the things that we really got wrong is, you know, the organization was very imbalanced. We were very focused on growth and revenue and sales and scaling, positioning for the IPO. And our investors were very happy about that. And they, you know, they're kind of foot race. We weren't the first to do virtual schools, which was one part of our business, but we were the first to go big and scale that up nationally in the United States, basically, in terms of starting and running virtual charter schools. And so we overweighted on that side of the business, but we underweighted on operations, finance, you know, some of the other. Now, product development, we did well. So we had a really good product, very high quality. You know, we're in the business of educating school children. But it really came back to bite us being underweighted on the operations side, on the finance side, where, you know, years into it, we ended up hitting some crises and some big challenges, and we were just not equipped. We just didn't have the resources to deal with it, basically. And it caused a lot of problems, caused a lot of extra. I mean, it was hard enough doing a startup scale up, you know, much less shooting yourself in the foot like that. I mean, we were very imbalanced, in my opinion. And so that was kind of a lesson learned the hard way. One of the lessons, you know, there's others certainly. So
can I tell you something that I've noticed? So I know you're not familiar with me, but so I've had 12 years in business, and it is a cool story. It started with, you know, 15 cases of sauce in my trunk. Today, it's still a small business in the grand scheme, 23 employees, a decent revenue, I'm not going to say, but you know, it's gotten to a point where I thought, oh my God, dreams come true if we ever get to that amount of revenue. And something I noticed is that the skill set of being a leader wasn't required in those first couple of years. Because the first couple of years, it was just hustle, work your ass off, round the clock, you're doing everything. And then eventually you start to get an employee or two, and then three or four, and then 10, and then 15, and then 20. And suddenly you're a leader, but that was never required. You got to that point without ever having to be good at it. And now all of a sudden they're looking at you. And are you good at it? Aren't you? No. The answer was no. I made a lot of mistakes, sometimes good, sometimes bad. But you've seen that as well. I can tell by the expression on your face. Do you know what I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. By the way, I literally just posted a blog last night about this, about how why is leadership so hard now? And I think it's even harder now for a lot of people, you know, with the disruption, with the geopolitical and AI and just all the other crazy stuff going on right now. But yeah, so I was very humbled, I would say. So we had three primary business lines when we started with this scale up K-12. And so we were going to start and run virtual charter schools. And that was the one that I ran. We were going to serve homeschool families. And it's a huge thing in this country. There's millions of homeschool children out there. It's a really interesting, fascinating. Many of them are very well educated. And then we were going to serve public and private school kids with supplementing their regular in-school education with our online, it's hybrid, online, offline resources. And the virtual school business ended up being the biggest business. It's just we weren't sure how it was going to shake out and ended up, you know, attacking that and did very well. And so initially it was about, as I said earlier, growth. And I was leading the school development team. So I was going out there to try to find partnerships and get virtual school approved state by state. And our goal was like, let's go after all 50 states and then let's go after the world. And but the charter school laws and regulations and the education laws, they're varied. We basically have 50 different school systems in this country. We don't have one school system. We're very kind of, it's a federalist kind of approach. And so I had a really good team. And so I was very fortunate, you know, to have hired well. And we were really good at the kind of school development piece. And so we would open up new things. And then I ended up also managing the schools that we got approved, basically. And so that became increasingly challenging as we grew to open all the new schools and to be managing them. And this was our biggest, you know, business line versus the homeschool and the supplemental. And initially it was fine. You were kind of doing okay, but then it got bigger and bigger and more complex. Now, mind you, I was just fresh out of my MBA, and I never worked in business before. I'd worked in a think tank and a foundation. Now, I had operational roles and was doing budgeting and hiring and all that, but this was much, much bigger scale, you know, bigger pressure. And it was like, go, go, go. We got to scale. We got to scale. And at some point, it just you know, it just went beyond my managerial acumen at the time. I just wasn't putting enough time and attention to the management side of things. And I was focusing more. And then that ended up causing problems for us. And so the founder came in and said, hey, Greg, you know, look, we're gonna take away the management piece and you can, you know, just focus on the development piece. And you know, that was very humbling at the time, you know, to have that, you know. Sure. But it was the right call. I mean, it was absolutely right. And I wasn't doing enough on that. I wasn't doing it well enough. And so it's a good lesson learned in terms of, you know, you really need to, you know, be able to step up your leadership as the venture grows, mm-hmm. right? And your capacity. And I just, what you know, I just hadn't yet found a way to do it. But thankfully, we brought in really good people and they did a good job. And you know, I was part of that handoff and we worked very well together. And so I was proud of that. But it was a humbling experience at the time, but also gave me that, you know, leadership is hard, you know, it's hard. And also like living well while you're leading, while you have the challenges of business and work, you know, with your family, with your health, yeah. with your relationships, you know, I was, you know, getting engaged at the time on my way to getting married and, you know, starting to develop some bad habits that, you know, for me weren't the way that I wanted to live and work. So ended up making some big adjustments after that.
One of the big early mistakes that I made, and I still make mistakes every day as a leader, but one of my first big mistakes was I had this theory that everyone would be a self-starter. And so when I had 6, 7, 8 employees, I started to kind of, this was kind of pre-SOPs. Like, you know, we were still kind of flying by the seat of our pants and everyone just kind of learned from tribal knowledge. I made the sauce and then I taught you how to make the sauce and now you know how to make the sauce. That was it. And so as we started to get more employees, I started to have this theory that I'm not going to tell them exactly how to do it because I wouldn't want to be told. They're going to just figure it out. They're going to want that autonomy. And man, things just kept going wrong. And I kept going, what is it? What is it? And so finally, you know, I come out with like a procedure and then I'm being thanked. They're going, thank you. We didn't know what you wanted. You wouldn't tell us what you wanted. We had to get. So I think I'm giving them freedom, but they think I'm just making them guess. And it was frustrating them. And it was a really bad move for me.
Yeah. I mean, that communication piece is so important, but also I think it, to me, what you just said points to that clarity piece. Like is the ultimate aim and the vision and the purpose clear? And if so, maybe they have enough, and then they can just decide how they're going to do it. And so that's one of the things. Are we doing a good enough job on the clarity piece? And I think often, you know, there's the curse of knowledge. It's clear to us in our head, so we assume it's clear to other people, but often it's not. And if you're growing and they've got their own context, that's different. You know, the other thing, Polly, that we encountered was we also got imbalanced with our culture. This was another real lesson learned. You know, I'm a really big believer. You know, my dad and I wrote a leadership book, and one of the chapters was focusing on building a culture of stewardship, by which we mean where people really own the purpose, the values, and the vision, and the ultimate quest of the organization. It's not that they're delegated or you're empowering them. It's that everybody owns it. They really feel a sense of ownership. Part of that comes from, like, together you've clarified what you're doing and what you want to do. But our culture was also imbalanced because we were this online education startup. And so about half of our team was educators, you know, teachers and curriculum experts and instructional designers. And they come out of the world of schools and families and wanting to help kiddos. And then the other half of our team was, we're a tech startup. And so it was kind of the engineering product development, you know, race, IPO. And it was like, you know, business and scaling and whatnot. And, you know, those people were excited about being part of a social venture with the social mission, but they also just wanted to go fast. And, you know, they didn't really understand the world of schools that we're in because they didn't come from that world. And so we have these two different pieces. And so trying to, we were really busy, Polly. I mean, we had like every day, it was like 1,000 things to do. And maybe you did 72 or maybe you did 51. And it was like, and then it would just keep growing and growing. So it's like this thing that's like, it's just insane how much you have to do. But in retrospect, we had, you know, what I now know is called organizational debt, where we weren't investing enough in our organization and our culture. And you can get away with that for a period of time, but at some point it's going to collapse, you know? And so that's another thing that just kind of came back to bite us, where, you know, we ended up kind of just having this gap between those two factions, but also between the headquarters and our schools out in the field that we're starting up. It's like, how do you actually bridge those culturally in terms of communication, in terms of operations and all those things? And man, it just takes a lot of time and intentionality to make sure you're locked in together.
I don't think we
did that well enough.
Are you a big fan of getting everybody in a room doing a, you know, so there's like the buzzword of corporate retreat, right? And like that, maybe when you hear that, I don't know, maybe that turns people off. Maybe people love that. But in general, let's get everyone in a room. Let's maybe even get out of our normal workplace. Let's go find a different room somewhere and let's put some big ideas up on the board and let's air some stuff out. Let's talk about what's going well and what's not going well. Is that something you recommend for organizations?
Definitely. So I'd say a couple things about that. So in the normal case, the base case, so alignment is just so key, organizational alignment, by which I mean clarity and cohesion, where everybody's rowing together in sync, and most organizations are not aligned. You know, many organizations are dysfunctional. Part of it in alignment is about both leadership and management coming together systematically, going through that process together to clarify. And so, you know, chapter 5 in our book deals with this. So we've got 5 practices for how to build an organization that's excellent and ethical and enduring. And that's what we call crown leadership in that book. And practice 5 is alignment, and that's where it all comes together. And you can do all the other practices about culture and other things that we talk about, but if you don't align, it's just knocking. And so, and you have to align long-term, medium-term, short-term. You have to align down, sideways, diagonally throughout the organization. You have to have these conversations, particularly as you grow, because things get more complex and you have these silos and these factions and whatnot. So it's this systematic work and it never ends. So you want to develop a cadence. And so that's the base case. And then I think it's also what you're talking about is extra when you run into trouble, when you have some kind of culture problem or you have a crisis, and to, you know, come together in a room, and we talk about, I mean, a lot of people talk these days about psychological speak, which is right, but before that, you need to have an almost emotional catharsis where you go around the room and people have an opportunity to kind of vent their frustration. Sure, like, you know, like, my God, I'm working double, and I haven't seen my kids, you know, in 3 days, and but you guys are being sick. And tell me this, or you changed it, and you know it wasn't clear, and you know, so first you give an opportunity for people to just kind of vent, and then you also have to just like actually identify all those and literally write them down on a board, you know. So you have, and you just keep going around and around until you got all the issues, and then you go prioritize them. What are our A issues? What are our B issues? We can't do them all. There's no way. You know, within the A, there's 12 issues, but we can only focus on two at once, and then we're going to go to 3 and 4, and you have to be really systematic. And without getting people in the room and having the vulnerability to hear that face to face, create a culture where it's like, no, it's shame. You know, it's about, we own this together, and we need to get through this together. And if we don't, we're going to fail. Let's just figure it out. You know, as long as it takes, let's figure it out together.
You have this thing on your website. It's the 4 types of people in any organization. And I loved this because then it says the 4th type is what's really killing you. And so it's leaders, followers, objectors, which is not a bad thing. Some people will hear that and go, oh, that's the bad one. No. Somebody has to sit in that meeting room when the dumb CEO like me comes up with an idea like today. Hey, can we put crushed tomatoes in 55-gallon drums? Something we've never done before, but the New York State prison system reached out to us and said, we'd like this ungodly amount of tomatoes. So I'm in a boardroom today telling my team, we're going to do 55-gallon drums, and I've got everyone saying, why would we do that? Why would they have to be able to ask me 5 times, you know, the 5 why, right? And unless I can answer 5 why, then I haven't thought out my idea well enough. So the objectors are good, but then the 4th one, these are the ones that kill you. The mutterers, or as I would say, the shit talkers, the people who wait till they're out of the room to go, well, that's stupid. Those are the killers. You're so right.
Yeah. Yeah. We need leaders, obviously. We need followers, obviously. And by the way, you know, there's, as I said, there's a lot of bad leaders in the world. You know, we see all sorts of examples. So good followership is so important, that dance between leaders and followers. And it's not just by title. It's not just you lead because you're the manager. And, you know, sometimes it changes places. So good followership is essential. But to your point, the objectors, the 3rd one, you know, a lot of people, it's kind of a hassle, but they're the ones who raise their hand and they ask a tough question, or they say, hey, we can't do that. And yeah, you need to have that healthy conflict, right? And if you don't have that, it's that you don't have trust and you don't have a high-performing team. A lot of people don't understand that. But the 4th one, the mutterers, that's where it really gets toxic. Mm-hmm. You know, they walk out of a meeting, everybody agreed, and then they just kind of whisper, that's such BS, or they're just kind of undermining, talking bad behind somebody. And that stuff is poison, and that stuff will spread. And so you really need to nip in the butt. You know, there's a really interesting, simple matrix. I think it was the Blanchard companies that did it. It's basically, you know, 2x2. And so you got performance, you have high performers and low performers on one axis. And then on the other axis, kind of ethics, right? And there's kind of people who are kind of ethically attentive and want to do the right, they're open and transparent. We're all human, so we all, you know, fall down. And then there's the ones who don't care about that. They'll just do whatever. They'll screw people up, pull over, you know, they'll sabotage you. And it's interesting because you obviously want people who are high in both, but you don't always have that. Low in both, that's pretty straightforward. But the really interesting case is when they're high performers, but they're low in ethics and culture. And this is where the mutterers are. And those people are basically vampires. And a lot of managers, they overlook those people. They're like, hey, you're bringing in the numbers, so I don't care. You know, don't ask, don't just keep doing it. But those people are poison. And you got to deal with those people. And often the way to deal with them is you want them out. And I saw this, you know, back in college, I played a lot of soccer growing up, and I was a co-captain of our soccer team. And we had a soccer team, Division III. It wasn't, you know, D1 or anything like that, but we had a good team. We're competitive with our league. We go to the regionals. And our coach was really strict. He was really into fitness, Paulie, and he was a Presbyterian minister. Like, having to do, he'd kind of put the fear of God into you with the punishment if you lost or whatever, the wind sprints or the suicides you'd have to do. But he wasn't the most advanced strategist for soccer. He was more of a football guy, kind of transitioned over. And so as we got better over the years with our recruiting, some of the guys kind of lost faith and they got really cynical about the coach, even though they were doing well. We had a really good team and he was great in many, many, you know, recruiting and other aspects, you know, discipline, you know, focus. But we had this muttering going on in the locker room and it just killed our season. It was just brutal. And, you know, me and my co-captain saw it differently and mm-hmm. we weren't on the same page. And so that was a whole other layer. And I'm, you know, and when you're a captain of a sport in like high school or college or something, there's no training for that. Yeah, you just, you know, it's like right. You just are a captain or whatever because you score a lot of goals or you're a good, you know, corner kick guy or whatever it is. So it's like, you know, but figure it out, you know. But that was a painful lesson. I saw the toxicity of the muttering.
By the way, the best backhanded compliment I've ever received was when I was in eighth grade. I was on the basketball team, but I was easily the worst player on the basketball team, but I was friends with everybody and they voted me captain. And the coach goes, Googs, captain, I don't understand it either. That's what he said.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, yes, coach, right?
all right, so Tuesday, May 12th, coming to Rochester, Riverside Convention Center, rochesterrotary.org, events to buy tickets. Greg, what do they see that day? What goes on stage? What are you going to talk about?
Yeah, so the theme of the day is crafting your life and work. It's one of the things we talked about a few minutes ago, which is that a lot of us, I think, you know, it's hard. You got the family and the personal life that you have things that you want to do, things that are important to you. Maybe you're married, maybe you have kids like you and I, and then work. You're committed. You want to do a good job. You want to be a successful professional or an effective leader. And bridging those is really difficult for a lot of people. And so it's about how do you intentionally craft your life and work so that you can do well in both. And so a few of the things that we'll do, one is we'll do a check on what I call the common traps of living. And so this is the subject of a new book that I'm working on right now. It's not out yet. And so the traps of living are the things, what are the things that are inhibiting our happiness and our quality of life? Right? A lot of times it's things like negative self-talk. It's about self-doubt and limiting beliefs. It's about overthinking and worrying. It's about drifting in your life or settling for just okay. It's about comparing yourself to other people too much in a way that's maladaptive or conforming to what your parents wanted or what your friends thought was cool as opposed to your own guiding lights. If you wanted to start that company, if you wanted to do the sauce company or, you know, whatever. And so putting a check on those traps, because the traps are like a broken record. If you don't identify your traps, it'll just keep playing and scratching over and over. So you got to kind of do the pattern interrupt and get better. Number two is we'll do a quality of life check. You know, our lives are multifaceted and it's about your health and your finances and your relationships and your fun and your learning and growth and your personal core. How are we doing across all that? You know, I don't know about you, but I'm not a perfect 10 across all those.
And, no, most, you know, of those things I'm not good at. Most of it. Yeah, I think you named 15 things and like 11 of them, I'm like, oh, that's me. Yeah.
That's the thing, Paulie. It's like these traps, you know, I call them the common traps of living because they're super common. I mean, I'll do this with a group of like high achievers and I'll say, like, raise your hand if you're not in any of those traps. And nobody raises their hand. Yeah. Raise your hand if you want to circle like 80% of them. And, you know, a lot of people raise it. We have a laugh, but it's actually true. And the same with the quality of life. It's hard, you know. So the point is not to berate yourself because you're not a perfect 10 across the board. I mean, that's unrealistic, you know, but is there a low one right now that's causing some pain or some damage with your spouse or with your kids or with your health, you know, that you really need to start to focus on. And then we're going to take action. We'll take focused action one by one. So that's another theme. And then I've got a whole process, you know, so it's like, well, how do I craft my life and work? Right. So it's like, it sounds good. I want to do that. But there's actually a process we can learn from human-centered design. We can learn some principles from entrepreneurship and leadership and self-leadership and psychology and philosophy. And so I kind of developed like a way to go about it that it's not rocket science. It's not super complex, but it's just hard to do because you just have to be disciplined and systematic. Yeah, it's kind of like we talked about earlier, like alignment. It's not rocket science, mm-hmm. but it's rare because people aren't as disciplined and systematic and intentional. So I'm kind of trying to bring that to people and say, hey, let's be successful in our work, but let's also have a good life and have some fun, you know, and, you know, be true to our values, spend some time with our kids and our friends and do that because we want the whole package. So.
Yes. Greg, I can't thank you enough for doing this. You are a big deal. And to take this much time to talk to little old me in Rochester, what a pleasure and an honor, sir.
No, it's an honor to talk to you. I love what you do. I've been listening to your podcast, so I followed your work a little bit. And Rochester is just a really, really impressive community. So I'm really looking forward to. I know, you know, some people there. I'm looking forward to getting to know the community more. Working with the Rotary and of course the Sunshine Camp. What an amazing organization! So this event that we're doing is designed to benefit the Rochester Rotary Sunshine Camp. So I'm just thrilled. I'm really looking forward to coming out there, meeting you and others in person, and having a good day together on May 12th.
It's going to be great, Greg. We'll see you on May 12th. Safe travels. Take care in Denver. Is the Mile High thing true? Like, do you really get winded earlier? You get it, like, is it tougher to walk around and stuff? You got to get used to it?
It is. My close friend from junior high school was just out here, and I was like, hey, stay hydrated. You know, we got to ease into it. It's definitely, it's an adjustment for people. And then, of course, you want to go up and hike in the mountains, too. And then it goes, starts at a mile and goes from there. So you got to acclimate. That's for sure. It's the real deal.
Are you, like, when you come to Rochester and you work out in the morning or something at your hotel, are you a beast because you're used to the Denver altitude?
I don't know. I would like to think so. I'm not so sure. Certainly nobody would notice a difference. But yeah, it is good. In soccer, we used to go from California to Colorado, and whenever we went to Colorado, they would kill us because we weren't acclimated to the altitude. But then when they'd come to LA to play or Claremont, you know, we would kill them because the smog was so bad that they couldn't breathe either. So it was kind of, it was an advantage either on the other side. So.
All right. Well, Greg, thank you so much. GregVanerick.com. And of course, May 12th, RochesterRotary.org events to buy tickets. Greg, thank you. Have a great day, man. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks, Polly. Great to be with you.
Hello, Rochester. This is Richard B. Cologne.
And Quanti Donnell.
We are the curators of the Behind the Glass Gallery, where we host monthly receptions on First Friday, showcasing three underrepresented artists from the Rochester area.
And on this podcast network, you can listen to us speak to these monthly artists to get another lens on their medium and how they contribute amazing things to the Rochester arts community.
Catch us at 240 East Main Street every First Friday and
on the Lunch at Door Podcast Network.
If you're a fan of Rochester's local music scene, you follow The Sound on Instagram to keep up on who's playing where. The folks behind The Sound have joined Lunch at Door to bring you nights and weekends, featuring conversations with musicians, venue owners, fans, and changemakers to talk about the growth and evolution of music in Rochester. Stay connected to the scene. Check out Nights and Weekends wherever you get your podcasts.
This has been a presentation of the Lunch at Door Podcast Network.